You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme.
Questa riforma è stata quella che abbiamo portato al voto.
This is the reform we asked Italians to vote on. We haven't been convincing, and I'm sorry, but we're leaving without any remorse. Democracy won, the no won, but we fought this battle with passion and determination.
It's déjà vu all over again. Another European Prime Minister loses a referendum and is forced to step down. We examine what Matteo Renzi's gamble means for both Italy and the future of the European Union. And we also look at Austria, where voters were able to stop the wave of populism, where they chose the Green Party candidate over the far-right one for president. We'll also be talking about Trump and his latest series of phone calls. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So hello, one and all, and welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle and Michael Binion. Samira Shackle is a journalist specialising in social affairs, politics, race and South Asia. And Michael Binion is a foreign affairs specialist for The Times. Samira and Michael, welcome to you both. We start today with a look at the European Union. This was a weekend that saw Austria stop the international wave of political populism with the election of the Green Party's Alexander Van der Bellen as president. And in Italy, where they rejected constitutional reforms, leading to the resignation of Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. Let's start in Italy.
Questa riforma è stata quella che abbiamo portato al voto.
This is the reform we asked Italians to vote on. We haven't been convincing, and I'm sorry, but we're leaving without any remorse. Democracy won, the no won, but we fought this battle with passion and determination. I wanted to eliminate the many chairs of Italian politics, the Senate, the provinces, the National Council for Economics and Labour, and I didn't make it. So the chair that is being cut is mine.
Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi stepping down there. Michael Binion, he staked everything on this constitutional reform, reform which, on the surface, to an outsider, looks like it isn't the biggest issue that Italy is facing. Would that outsider be wrong?
Well, in a way, it is a big issue because unless you get a government machine that is able to take decisions, then you can't get the other reforms done that need doing, and there are plenty that need doing. It's not a reform that is on the minds of most Italians. They're worried about the economy, about jobs, about getting things moving, and they're angry about the European Union for failing to take more migrants from Italy. I mean, Italy is overwhelmed with migrants coming up from across the Libyan desert over the Mediterranean into Italy. So they had other things on their minds. And the other thing that I think is the big issue is simply, if ever you call a referendum, it doesn't matter what the question, the answer is always the same. And the answer is a punch on the nose for the government. And that's what they got.
Samira, in a sense, it was very easy for the opposition here, particularly the Five Star Movement and the La Liga, the Northern League, because this didn't have to be a positive vote for them. They could simply say, look at this guy, look at what Matteo Renzi has done or hasn't done over the past 2.5 years. This is your chance to boot him out rather than this is a chance to vote for us.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like a real own goal to have said sort of relatively early that he'd stand down in the event of losing the referendum because, you know, as we saw in our own referendum on the European Union, which obviously was completely different, but the similarity is that it was a sort of fairly nebulous question to put to the electorate. Lots of people might not be at the forefront of their minds exactly what it means, so it can easily become a sort of cipher for all sorts of other issues. And I think, as Michael says, this constitutional reform might not be the most sort of pressing issue for most Italians. And having a vote on such an abstract topic, when the Prime Minister said, I'll step down if I lose, it makes it very, very easy for that to essentially become a referendum on his premiership. So that was a silly move, I think.
Michael, Matteo Renzi has an excellent reputation outside of Italy. He is seen by many as a strong leader in Europe. He was feted recently by Barack Obama, who invited him to a state dinner in the White House and said about how he's a great reformer. But inside Italy, it's clear that the 2.5 years he had in office weren't seen by many Italians as a period of progress.
Well, I think outside Italy, of course, he's seen as a man who is smart, sharp, sober, and doesn't have bunga-bunga parties. But at the same time, inside Italy, he's not seen as a person who got the things done immediately that they want done immediately, namely create more jobs, raise living standards, deal with the bad debts that are all over the banks and are really causing economic paralysis, and particularly deal with the immigration question. It's a tall order to get those all sorted in 2.5 years. He is a sharp, smart fellow, and he says, I think disingenuously, he leaves with no remorse. I mean, if he leaves with no remorse, why on earth did he have the question in the first place, if it's all the same to him? But I think it is a great shame for many outside Italy that he's gone, and I think many Italians will regret his passing. It depends very much, of course, who succeeds him.
I want to come on to that issue in a moment, but first, Samir, on this issue of refugees and migrants who have arrived in Italy, as Michael said, they've mainly those that arrived in Italy have come from throughout Africa, through Libya, across the sea to Lampedusa and beyond. And Matteo Renzi was, had a similar stance to Angela Merkel, which was, we cannot turn these people away, we cannot watch them drown, we will save them. But once they're here, we need the support of others in Europe to help give them shelter and give them somewhere to live. And he didn't have that help, did he? Which then made it very awkward, particularly in the north of Italy, where the Northern League was strong, for them to make it part of this referendum campaign, the fact that Renzi wasn't dealing with this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that across all sorts of different European countries, you're seeing the domestic fallout from a broader Europe-wide failure of policy on this issue. And there's been a sort of consistent issue about European countries not sort of wanting to work together. And I'd say not just in the refugee crisis of the last couple of years. This is a policy failure that's been brewing for years, if not decades. Lack of clarity about what happens when you are faced with a surge in migration and sort of how that should be equally distributed, and sort of across the board lack of willing to take responsibility and share that out fairly. And I think we're now seeing the domestic ripples in different formats in different countries across Europe.
It's striking, Michael, isn't it, that despite the fact that Matteo Renzi seemed to be well liked by many of his fellow European leaders, none of them were prepared to help him here, were they?
Well, in the end, national interest trumps everything else, and people knew very well the mood in their own countries, which was look to your own first. And there is tremendous hostility, especially in Eastern Europe, where the whole idea of quotas was absolutely unacceptable, partly because they have no tradition yet of a multicultural society. They are still very homogenous societies, and partly because, having only just achieved what they regard as full sovereignty themselves, they weren't going to be told by Brussels how to deal with their internal affairs. And other countries are sensitive to immigration. We've seen the result in Britain of the immigration question becoming really toxic for the government. The result is that they lost the referendum on Europe, which was actually not a referendum on immigration, but it became that. So I think all countries know how difficult this is as an issue, and therefore it's very, very hard to get common agreement on what to do about people.
Samir, I want to, before we move on to Austria, I just want to look at what happens next in Italy. I mean, the only thing anyone can say with any certainty is that we're entering another period of uncertainty, which perhaps isn't uncommon for Italy over the past couple of decades. But when you look at the options for what comes next, as we were saying, this wasn't a positive vote for the Northern League. It wasn't a positive vote for the Five Star Movement. Where the Five Star Movement have won local elections in Turin and Rome, those victories seem to have fairly quickly unravelled as they've struggled somewhat in office. Does Italy need fresh elections now? Is it going to be happy with something cobbled together?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I think they don't constitutionally need to have a fresh election in the same way that we didn't need to have a fresh election after the Brexit referendums. They do sort of, they're within their legal rights not to hold one. And I think that the main parties will be reluctant to hold one because of the potential surge in support for the Five Star Movement or the Northern League. And I think, though, that it's very difficult to say, and it's sort of tempting, as it's, you've seen in lots of the coverage of it this morning, to sort of cast it in the same mould and think of this as a sort of repeat of the Brexit vote or the Trump vote or whatever. And it's not really that clear-cut because, as you say, it was a vote for the status quo. Apart from anything else, it was something backed by two out of the three main parties in Italy. And while those who support the populist movements probably did vote that way, there's also a whole load of other people who probably were voting for different reasons. So I think it's not a sort of clear that were there to be an election now, there'd be a resounding victory for either of those parties. But I think regardless, there'll be a reluctance from the establishment in Italy to risk it.
OK, let's cross over the border into Austria. Sigmar Gabriel, Germany's deputy chancellor and the leader of the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, that's obviously part of Angela Merkel's coalition, said, Michael Binion, that the result there, the presidential result, which saw Alexander von der Bellen beat Norbert Hofer, was a massive relief for the whole of Europe. It's saying something, isn't it, that when a mere 46% of the population vote for a far-right candidate, that we can say that's a massive relief for the whole of Europe.
Yes, you could say it's the best showing they've ever had for the far right in Austria. And indeed, they are well poised to form a part of a next coalition when Austria has general elections in probably next year. The thing is that they were only voting for a figurehead in Austria. They weren't voting for somebody who actually runs the country. The president in Austria is not an executive president. But because he isn't an executive president, he represents a national mood, an aspiration. He is the ceremonial head of the country. And for that reason, symbolically, it was tremendously important for both Germany and Austria not to have someone whose party, in some ways, is the heir to the Nazi party. It was, after all, formed by former ex-Nazis after the Second World War. It has strong associations with former Nazis. It isn't clearly the same party at all, but the associations are just too painful for either Germany or Austria to see that spectre come back again.
It's interesting you mention that, because unlike in Germany, where there was a complete reckoning post-Second World War with what had been done in Germany's name, that didn't happen in Austria, did it?
No, it didn't. And Austria gave itself the image, or it promoted the image, that they in fact were one of the victims of Nazi Germany, whereas in fact they were willing accomplices. I mean, they were forcibly merged into Germany, but if you look at senior positions in the Nazi party, many of them were Austrians who held those positions. But that was conveniently glossed over after the Second World War, and it invented itself as a small, neutral, friendly, sort of Switzerland-like type country in the centre of Europe, which has served Austria extremely well, economically and in every other way. There have been look-backs at the past, and more recently, certainly not as comprehensively of Germany, but I think now the younger generation does feel that Austria cannot be tarred by association with what happened 70 years ago, and that's why they are quite sensitive to this issue.
Samira, Alexander von der Bellen has last night was saying this was a victory for liberal politics, for pro-European politics. He was very clear that this was a pro-European campaign. I mean, you know, the fact that a pro-European gets 50-odd% of the vote in the heart of Europe, one of the with a country that's been a member of the European Union for a very long time. That shouldn't be a huge surprise, but it's perhaps a positive sign for those that want to see a more united Europe.
Yeah, I think so. And also that those who voted for him ranked that as, I think it came out as the second most important, or one of the very most important reasons that they did vote for him, was his support for Europe. And it's interesting that Hofer had to reel back from his declared Euroscepticism previously as well. So it was very much against the public mood. So I think that is heartening for those who want to see a continued united Europe. And it's also, once again, indicative of the fact that it's very difficult to generalise, even though it's tempting to sort of see a sort of wave of populism sweeping Europe or whatever it is. And while elements of that may be true, it's difficult to generalise, and it's different in each case.
Indeed. And on that point, it's interesting that Nigel Farage, the one-time leader of UKIP here in the UK, went on Fox News in the US last week saying that he thought Norbert Hofer was going to win, and that once he'd won, he'd have a referendum on pulling Austria out of the European Union, which Mr. Hofer was furious about and has now publicly blamed Farage for his defeat.
Yeah, I thought it was quite funny that sort of, Nigel Farage restyling himself as an international sort of soothsayer of far-right politics. It's a bit grim. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that. And also I think that given that UKIP so strongly throughout the referendum campaign maintained that it was about leaving Europe and not about immigration, it's interesting that Farage is so explicitly choosing to align himself with far-right forces. But yeah, I think that it just shows that the flashpoints, while there are some commonalities between European countries, for instance, I think the refugee crisis is an issue across Europe, there are also big differences.
One area where we can see similarities, Michael, is in this urban-rural divide that we've seen in a number of elections. And it was interesting, I haven't seen a map hasn't been produced yet for Austria based on last night's vote. But certainly on the first vote, you saw that Van der Bellen won Vienna and lost pretty much everywhere else. And you're seeing this across Europe and indeed in America as well, where cities think one thing and rural populations think something else.
Well, that's absolutely true. And in Austria, of course, the divide is even bigger because Vienna is disproportionately large as a capital city compared with the rest of the country. I mean, almost half all the people in Austria live in Greater Vienna, which is an extraordinary figure. But also, across the world generally, and this is not just a recent phenomenon, but it has been true for many years, cities tend to be more radical in their approach to politics. They have an urban proletariat, whereas the countryside tends to be more conservative, more religious, more pious, more harking back to old values, and therefore more easily influenced by people promoting a vision of a sort of stable past and railing against sort of modern life and modern trends.
Okay, we'll take a quick break there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. When we return, we'll be talking about President-elect Donald Trump and certain phone calls he's been making to world leaders.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18:18 here in London, 13:18 on the East Coast. Still with me here in Studio One, Samira Shackle and Michael Binion. We turn now to the United States, its relations with the world, and President-elect Donald Trump's latest series of phone calls with world leaders. We'll talk about Taiwan in a moment, because that's the one that's perhaps been most in the news. But first to Pakistan. Samira Shackle, should we read out the transcript of the phone call between Nawaz Sharif?
It's good.
Because it is quite good. Basically, the Pakistani Prime Minister's press office put out a statement which essentially seems to be everything Donald Trump said. And it's I'll read you some highlights. He said, Prime Minister Sharif, you are a terrific guy. You're doing amazing work, which is visible in every way. I feel I'm talking to a person I've known for a long time. Your country is amazing with tremendous opportunities. Pakistanis are one of the most intelligent people. I'm ready and willing to play any role that you want me to play to address and find solutions to the outstanding problems. Feel free to call me anytime. I like that. He said he'd love to come to Pakistan, which he describes as a fantastic country, fantastic place of fantastic people. Samira Shackle, he seems to quite like Pakistan, or is that just the way Donald Trump talks about everything?
I think that is just the way he talks, because during the election campaign, I'm pretty sure he said that Pakistan was one of the most dangerous countries in the world. And he also obviously spoke about banning Muslim immigration to the US, which obviously I don't know if anyone's told him that Pakistan's sort of 95% Muslim population.
Well, it says here, all Pakistanis I've known are exceptional people.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, it's
exceptional people who won't be allowed to come to America, apparently, but yeah, there we are.
Exactly. It's bizarre. It seems to be a kind of improvised foreign policy. I was reading, I think John Kerry had said that he basically asked for zero briefings from the State Department about how to handle it, and even about sort of what American foreign policy positions are on different countries. Had he done that, he would know that relations are currently quite tense between America and Pakistan, and that Pakistan's quite isolated diplomatically at the moment. So perhaps that context is why Nawaz Sharif was quite so gleeful about publishing those comments.
Well, indeed. And Michael Binion, as amusing as this is actually rather serious, isn't it? Because if you're an Indian diplomat, you're looking at that thinking, oh, hang on, what's going on here?
Well, of course, they'll read into it all sorts of things, which they shouldn't, because I think it's just a load of blather. He's just trying to make kind of, you know, polite conversation or chummy conversation. And you almost felt he said at the end, by the way, are there any contracts I could pick up while I'm over there? Mm-hmm. But the fact that the text has been published means that people will think that this is a carefully calibrated and well thought out exchange, which it isn't at all. But in that exchange, there was a key phrase about if there are any problems there where I could be helpful to you. And the Pakistanis will immediately say, well, you could intervene on Kashmir. And that's the one thing calculated to drive India berserk, because they have no wish for any outsider to be involved in the bilateral issue of Kashmir, which has been dogging India-Pakistani relations ever since the two countries became independent.
Well, indeed, on that point, Samira, do you think that he would try to involve himself in Kashmir? He says, trying to even imagine Donald Trump involving himself in the Kashmiri situation?
I hope not. I did hear on the radio the day after the election his foreign affairs advisor saying that Trump would be able to bring a very fresh perspective to the Israel-Palestine conflict due to the fact that he'd written The Art of the Deal, which I imagine is the same sort of logic here. But I mean, for obvious reasons, I don't think that will be particularly helpful to either of those intractable political conflicts.
And of course, Michael, there's also the issue of Afghanistan here, and you know, and the role that Pakistan plays, both in a helpful and perhaps less helpful way.
Absolutely, yes. And this has been a very difficult and ambiguous role for American presidents to deal with for, well, ever since the Afghan war began. I mean, ever since 2001. Where Pakistan has changed sides. It supported the Taliban, then it said it didn't support the Taliban, then it appeared to help try to promote some peace dialogue, which didn't really come to anything. Nobody really knows what role they're playing, and I don't think Pakistanis themselves do either.
Let's now look at the situation with China and Taiwan. Samira, so over the weekend, what we know is this. There was a phone call between President-elect Trump and President Tsai of Taiwan. That's the first time that the leaders of those two countries have spoken or appear to have spoken since 1979. The US has always had a policy of not treating Taiwan as if it is an independent nation, although obviously also selling it lots of weapons to protect it from China. It's complicated, it's complex, and one gets the impression that either Donald Trump wants to change policy with China over Taiwan, or the result of a 10-minute conversation and the fallout from that means he's going to.
Yeah, it does seem that way. And again, this is one of those instances where you sort of wonder how much of it is, as you say, about what sort of deliberate policy change. You know, he made China quite a big issue during the during his election campaign and in his own scattershot way has sort of talked about Chinese dominance and sort of Chinese exports driving down costs in the US and so on. So, you know, there is that, but there's also the fact that this is one in a steady stream of apparently very improvised foreign policy positions, which don't appear to be particularly well thought out. So I'd imagine it's somewhere between the two, and that, you know, he's taken quite a belligerent stance since going on Twitter and sort of sounding off that Beijing has no right to say who he can and can't speak to. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because it's, you know, it's something that could potentially have absolutely huge ramifications if those tensions step up to a much bigger degree.
Michael, does it matter if he annoys or frustrates the government in China?
It doesn't matter if he annoys them, but it depends whether he follows through on annoying them. I think the Chinese have reacted quite wisely of clearly making it known that they're unhappy about this and letting other commentators express those feelings, but themselves being quite low-key in the coverage of this, because they, I think, read Trump very well. They know he makes it up as he goes along. They also know that it's just as possible he could have said something that could have been quite China-friendly if he'd been in the mood, or if he'd suddenly felt that it offered America enormous market opportunities all of a sudden, and that this would solve some of his other problems over getting jobs into America. He could have gone either way. What they do know is that he is unpredictable, that is something they don't like. No government really likes an unpredictable person at the other end of their negotiations. They know that he is just trying to make a name for himself and be seen and be there and, you know, send out all these tweets all over the time. So they're playing it very cool at the moment. It depends whether he follows up on this.
When I've been talking to diplomats and people who work in that region, they have been a little more cautious about the impact that Donald Trump can have, because they have said, well, look, there is a framework in place that has been there for generations that you can't just at the click of a fingers change. There is machinery. You can't simply, you know, he can't simply step away from the region, for instance. Do you think that we do sometimes jump off the deep end a little bit when we see a new statement or a tweet about policy? You think that actually not much will necessarily change on the ground?
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's very unlikely, for example, that there will be any change in, for example, America recognising the People's Republic as the legal representative at the United Nations of China and go back to having Taiwan in its place or anything like that. That would be completely absurd. And as you say, there is a whole framework, particularly in trade and in arms, global arms discussions and things of this kind, where China and America are bound in by what they've already agreed. I don't think that will change. Trump may make some statements that will annoy the Chinese, but these are going to be fairly impromptu statements, and I think it depends, of course, who is his Secretary of State. That is the one thing we don't know. If he has a very belligerent Secretary of State, if he has John Bolton, for example, then this might herald a real change in policy, and Bolton and one or two others might be tempted to follow it through with the changing the machinery. But we'll have to see who he appoints.
Samir, of course, he may end up having a Secretary of State whose job is to go around and say, ah, yes, what the President really meant to say was...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it does seem that that might well be the case, on not just for Secretary of State, but for in various other things as well. I mean, he's clearly demonstrated that he's got a very impulsive personality. It doesn't strike me that he'll particularly want to spend the sort of long evenings reading through pages and pages of legislation that past presidents might have done. So I think that's definitely going to be something for his team to tackle, is sort of making a sort of translating those perhaps improvised or impulsive, less than temperate statements into sort of viable policy positions.
And Michael, just finally, is this the sort of thing, that behaviour you can get away with if you're a superpower? Is it actually, if you're a smaller nation, if let's say Britain had a Trump-like figure who was Prime Minister, would that actually be a little bit harder for the UK to get away with, because people would think, well, OK, well, we don't need to take it from you?
It would be harder for others to accept would think this is really diplomatic nonsense. But it would also be harder at home. I don't think the British public would accept it. Whereas the Americans sort of laugh it off and say, well, you know, we voted for a guy really showing that he's made of something, he's original and whatever. I mean, some Americans will be appalled, but I think Trump can get away with it in his own country much more than another leader could. I mean, you take the example of somebody who said a whole range of offensive things that yet survived would be Berlusconi in Italy. But he survived 7 years and various people had to apologise on his behalf, but the Italians, in the end, got fed up with it. But he got away with it for a long time.
He did. There we are. Cool. Leave it right there. Michael Binion and Samira Shackle, thank you both indeed. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, by Alexis Soggle, by Naomi Joseph. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. We've got music next. Then at 1900, it's Culture with Robert Bound. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.